Ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to the Academy of Physical Medicine and 90 minutes of live CPD. CPD that counts as learning with others for all the osteopaths and chiropractors watching, and damn good CPD for everybody else. We have a very special guest with us this evening, two special guests in fact. We have John Graham, who is a very, very experienced physiotherapist and has a great deal of experience now in the technological field of rehabilitation. I hope you liked Amy Winehouse, by the way. Very appropriate, we all thought. And we have a mystery guest who will be introduced a little later in the broadcast. But first of all, John, welcome to APM. It's very nice to see you. I've watched you speak on this subject once before, and it was absolutely fascinating. Hence, I'm so pleased that you've come in this evening. You've got, 20 years' experience in technological rehab?
Well, prior to becoming a physio, I worked in the IT industry for 2 years and was very interested in medical computing and medical applications. But then started to drift, become more interested actually in the medical side of it. So having qualified as a physio, I carried that interest on and married up my technology interest with my physical therapy interests.
And you're based primarily now in Northampton, is that right, at the Chris Moody Centre?
Yes, we've expanded it as a company over the last 10 years. So we have a chain of clinics from North Yorkshire down to London. The head office is in Northamptonshire, and my main clinic was at the CMC in Moulton.
So do you do any of the horrible hands-on stuff anymore?
Well, if we could ask for the triad slide to go, if that's okay. What's really core to our practice is the idea of what I've termed the rehabilitation triad, and that's based on the idea that at any given point in the patient's journey, we're looking at the application of hands-on therapy, exercise, and technology. Now, the technology could be very low tech. Doesn't have to be the all singing, all dancing electrical things, or indeed our special guest as who we'll meet later. It's basically something that isn't hands-on, something that isn't exercise, that will either assist as part of rehabilitation or actually help perform a function. So low tech could be as simple as making sure a walking aid is at the right height with a correct ferrule, and high tech could involve electrical stimulation. So really, to me, rehabilitation is about looking at accurate assessment of that patient and saying, okay, what's the mix that they need? What's the mix between what my hands can do with that patient? What exercises can I supervise now? What exercises can I send that individual home with? And what technology can assist in both of those scenarios?
So it sounds to me as though this is potentially quite an expensive option, which I presume is available through the National Health Service?
Our main business activity is private practice.
Right. Okay.
However, because of the range of technologies and the therapy skills you can bring to bear, we often are able to get NHS contracts as an exceptional case basis. Right. So we'll take a very challenging patient that the NHS can't quite manage that mix of input and take them through their journey.
So what's the range of patients? What are the likely problems that will come your way?
So about 50% of our workload is our patients who've had a stroke, and then the rest of it is made up of people who've had a head injury, a spinal cord injury, Parkinson's disease, and then complex trauma. So those people that may have had a motorcyclists seem to be our sort of a very common client for us, whereby they've got some very challenging orthopedic injuries, some challenging neurological damage, both in the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, and often because there's not a lot between them and the gravel, often fairly challenging skin issues as well.
Yeah. And is the technology you're using designed primarily to replace the patient's capabilities, or is it there designed to help them regenerate that capability, rehabilitate the function?
It's both. Technology that will literally be strengthening or helping with spasticity, or technology that once you've got to the end of that journey, you say, well, look, okay, we're much more functional than we were, but you may need to carry on using that. So if we load a couple of examples up, you know, this gentleman came to see me 15 months after his stroke, and he's quite interesting for a stroke patient. I'm sure many of the listeners will have had some experience of stroke patients whereby they can make a grip with their hand, but they can't release it. So
Okay, so this is your gentleman who's, who can grip it.
So his is, so this is he's different to your conventional stroke because he can grip. So if we can we play the video? Yeah. So there he's gripping, and he's got some release, but he's just not turning those movements into anything functional. We're not asking for a difficult task here. We're just saying, can you squeeze that 4-inch ball, lift it up, and pop it in the basket? And he's got a lot of the components that you'd need for that. He's just weak. Now, if we stop that video now, and then we look at how he's able to respond when I give him a, on video number 22, what I've done here, I've put an electrical stimulator onto his extensors, both his fingers and his thumb, so he can put his wrist in a functional position, use the grip that he's got. So if we play that video now, you'll see the electrical pads, they're over the motor nerve and the motor end plate. And this is on a timer, so it's on for so many seconds, it's off for so many seconds. So this is all we've done, we've just applied this electrical stimulator, these devices, about 70 pounds, to those muscles. He's getting that background of extension from which he can then use the flexion that he's got. And so straight away he's gone from not being able to lift a ball at all to being able to do five, six in the space of this video.
And to what extent is that going to allow him, without the electrical stimulation, to reproduce that movement?
So if we go back, if we drop out of there and I select the next video, what we did, we sent him away for a month and we said we want you to practice this for 20 minutes twice a day. This is him 1 month later. He's practiced 20 minutes a day, twice a day. And when this video is playing, bear in mind at this point, he's not got the stimulation on. The stimulator box is on the table beside him. So if we play that video now, you'll see he's tearing through that, through those. So that's 1 month of therapeutic electrical stimulation. Yeah. So we've married up that repetition of open and close.
Yeah.
But we've used the technology to facilitate that, to allow him to do that. And that's 1 month of motor learning later.
That's quite remarkable. I had always assumed that electrical stimulation was great for building muscle, but presumably there's more going on there because he's had to relearn the coordination of those muscles as well.
Well, one of his biggest problems is he's got isolated wrist extension, but he lacks the stamina. So over that month, he's built some more tonic control, more stamina type activities. Yeah. He's also getting, because when you stimulate a motor nerve, that most of those nerves, it's not a pure motor nerve, it'll be a mixed nerve, so you'll get signals going both ways. Yes. So if you think about an action potential, it's going in one direction. Mm. When you artificially stimulate a nerve, it's going in both directions. So his brain is getting flooded with much more sensory information than he's perhaps getting.
And what's happening in the brain at the time? Is that just the normal plasticity sort of creating new pathways to control those movements?
I think with this chap in particular, I think it's more peripheral in terms. There's going to be a mix, but he's just purely that muscle is weak. So there's going to be metabolic changes within that muscle as well. So
I was just going to ask before we move on. Is that the same muscle stimulation equipment that you would have in any physio or osteopathic clinic?
Yes.
You know, so anyone could start trying to do that in their own clinic, or you could presumably the best thing is for the patient to take it home and use it over and over again.
The idea would be like this gentleman. You'd have your own units. You'd put it on the patient. Be happy that they're getting the movement that you want, and then send them away because again, it's back down to whatever it is. But it's repetition that rebuilds motor programs, builds strength, stretches out time.
We had Tim Watson on the program some time back, and as you know, he's very experienced in electrotherapy of all sorts. And it was interesting that he was talking about how the most useful thing for ultrasound is they give people the kit and make them go away with it rather than come back in once or twice a week for 10 minutes of therapy. And clearly, with someone so badly damaged, then that's going to be just as important for rehabilitating stroke. I was going to ask you, though, I'm actually treating a stroke patient myself at the moment, and I've actually managed to make a big improvement with his gait, which I'm very pleased about because I'm not experienced in dealing with this sort of injury, not certainly not to the extent you are. What I haven't been able to do is anything about the sort of spasticity of his arm.
Right. When,
you know, so he hasn't got a proper arm swing, which isn't which is influencing his sort of apparent limp.
Yeah.
Is that something which would be improved by this sort of therapy?
The upper limb spasticity, it's quite, there's quite a few sources for that. So when this video plays, you'll see this gentleman walking down a corridor, and he's got quite a marked foot drop.
Mm.
And as he comes back down the corridor, you'll see a very spastic appearing arm.
Yes.
And that would sort of make the heart of most physios sink, because that looks like it's going to be tough. Now, if we go on to the next video, video four, the only intervention we've done there is to address that foot drop.
Yeah.
So we've got a perineal nerve stimulator. So we're stimulating the perineal nerve.
Same equipment again, same functional electrical stimulation.
Well, the device with the previous gentleman was what I term therapeutic electrical stimulation.
Right.
So it's on a time base. It's on for so many seconds, off for so many seconds.
Right.
Functional electrical stimulation needs some kind of trigger to help you achieve function. So he's got a trigger in his heel. So when his heel comes off the ground, the peroneal nerve stimulator is made to go on. You see here he's getting his heel strike. But if we look where his arm's right down now by his side.
Any theories why that's
well,
happened?
So if you imagine if we're in the winter when we're walking over ice, if we videoed ourselves walking on ice, we'd have a very different looking gait to walking on a firm carpet indoors. And that's just exaggerated in a neurological condition. So we might be aware of increased tension, but we're able to dampen that down with our inhibitory pathways.
Yeah.
But one of the big thing post-brain injury is the loss of inhibitory pathways. So he's worried about tripping up with that foot. So there's a raised tension throughout his nervous system, but he just can't gate that out for his upper limb. So if we take away that challenge to the balance system, give him a heel strike, give him a foot that's not going to catch, then that drops out.
What's the long-term effect of this? Does he lose the foot drop?
So the long-term, if we look at number 24, his big goal was that he wanted to run. And this is him some 18 months after, he was using this device now every day. So if we play this video, this is 18 months later. There he is running again. Now, there's no way the stimulator can be stimulating that. It's too fast. The gait cycle with the gait cycle for walking is going to be much longer than the transition between the 2 feet in a run. So the device simply can't keep up with a run. But the motor learning that he's undergone in the 18 months preceding that has meant that he's started to recover some foot lift automatically, plus he's still getting some stimulation, but it's lasting perhaps into the second and third stride without him catching. And then if we look at video number 23, on his other videos I'd start him off with an external device, and here he is now. Just he's actually now had that surgically implanted.
Okay.
So rather than being on a cuff, so if this plays, this is just where he's up to now. So he's still using FES, but it's had a much more global effect on his whole walking gait.
It's quite an interesting machine.
It's an amazing machine, isn't it?
Yeah.
He bought it in a pub in Manchester. I'll say no more. So it's a split.
Yeah.
It's a split treadmill. So for him, to address that spasticity, we had to address his gait, because that was the driver for the tone. So, if we look at the next one, if we look at video number 10, our key for him was completely away from the arm. We didn't touch the arm. So this young lady's so we play this video. She's eight months post stroke, and this is her best attempt at trying to pick up some balls. Now,
and put them down.
And put them down. And it's all driven by the other hand.
Yeah.
She doesn't really get much elbow elbow extension. And even with this cheaty method, she can just about manage the juggling ball, but can't let go of it.
She can't let go, yeah.
And
it's interesting to reflect as well. She's actually quite a young patient, isn't she?
Oh, she is. She was in her 20s. Yeah. But now, she, despite having a sort of strong, can't let go of things grip, she hasn't got the end range of the end range of flexion. So if we close that one down, but you can see the degree of spasticity there is there. Yeah. So fairly fixed limb. So if we do look at number 17. So in this video, what we've done, we're going a peripheral to the hand.
Yeah.
So even though the spasticity is based in the elbow and the shoulder, we're giving her arm a purpose to move, because otherwise she's just waving around a fist. So when this video plays, we've got a special hand splint on there called the Saber Flex. So that uses springs to help her open and close the hand. So can we run that again a couple of times? So she has got active grip, so she's using the grip that she's got. But just on top of that, you should be able to see some springs. And as she relaxes the grip, she'll eccentrically lengthen the flexors. So if we go back to the main video screen, there should be a video sort of de-hit for a month later. So kill that one down. If you go for 6 weeks, number 18.
So now here she's going to be without the...
Yeah, so this is her without. Yeah, she's been using it 3-4 times a week. Now, if you remember in that first video, she couldn't grab that ball. She's still looking a little bit tight in the elbow, but the spasticity's coming out of that hand. So that's six weeks. So this is 18 months later, and straight away you can see where the spasticity's got to. So if we play, so we play this one now.
That's a hell of an improvement, isn't it?
Yeah. And that took 18 months. I have to say, she'd make a romantic error in the meantime, and that put a bit of a block on her therapy. So I think she probably could have achieved that in 6 to 9 months.
And the long-term end result,
she's driving with two hands, cutlery. Yep. She works in a call centre. She's got married.
Yeah.
She's somebody who, again, it was very light touch. So we provided the technology, provided the treatment program to go with it. She was certainly self-motivated enough to do it 2-3 times a week.
Yeah.
If she'd been in a position to do it more often, that I think she'd have got better faster.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is we've driven it from just the hand.
Mm-hmm.
The brain having a purpose to move that hand in space and achieving something functional. It's all changed up there. She's done no specific upper limb stretches. She's sort of or she's auto stretched, if you like.
And when we look at your triad, what's going on in addition to this?
So in this one, she's very low on hands on, simply because she's for various reasons. She's somebody who wanted to train at home,
and
finance being one of them. Yeah. So she's very much in the exercise technology side. So she's got the technology to assist in the hand opening, and she's got a strong home exercise program to carry on.
What sort of what regime would she have been following?
So she'll have been working for half an hour to 40 minutes a day, setting up. You can see those foam balls and those exercise, those collapsible crates that one gets from the DIY type shops. So we set those up in various scenarios. So you might just be moving the balls across, you might be moving them over crates, you might be putting the balls in a crate on the floor, but you're using the glove for about 30 minutes to relax off the flexors, and then to take the glove off and then do as many as you can, both the big balls and then working on golf balls and marbles afterwards. The key thing is, although it's a flexion activity, when we're flexing, I don't know if the camera can pick that up, if I'm flexing here, you can clearly see how hard my extensors have to work. But when I'm flexing down here, they work less hard, which is why in martial arts, if you're trying to remove something from somebody's hand, you put it into flexion and they'll drop it.
Yeah.
And it goes right back to evolution with monkeys swinging from trees. We're functionally strong with our wrist in that.
Yeah. I just want to have a quick chat to the audience because it's been pointed out to me that there's some sort of glitch in the chat facility that says we're offline. We're not offline. If you click the button at the bottom right, we will get your questions and we will answer them. And we'll try and sort out why it's doing that tomorrow. It's partly because we've introduced new technology so that you've got a happy, cheery face of whoever's talking to you when you call in. But don't believe it. We are online. Back to you, John.
Yeah.
So let's take somebody who is less technologically driven. What's the hands-on physiotherapy approach to someone that you're rehabilitating this way?
So the hands-on approach is if you think, I mean, I developed years ago a simple model to help explain it to some junior physios terrified of meeting a stroke patient for the first time. So they asked a really clever question. It was, well, hang on a minute. We're not understanding neuro, but we understood orthopedics. Can we not just use orthopedic strengthening? Mm. And it got me thinking, well, actually, yes, you can, but there's a few provisos. If you get the provisos, then just use that same thinking process. So by and large, as a consequence of a stroke or a head injury, there will be muscles that are weak. So that individual is still going to potentially want to be functional, so they will try their level best to achieve a movement, and how they do that can determine the future development of tone. So you want them to move, you want them to be active, but you want to make sure that tone then doesn't become maladaptive. And there's an overlap to a certain extent with orthopedic medicine. So if someone's got a rotator cuff injury, they will potentially have a reverse scapular rhythm to lift something to their mouth, which will then start to give them neck issues. Yep. So part of it with the stroke patient is saying, well, that they may be less aware because they're not getting so much sensation and proprioception, less aware of the compensation that they're making. So it's the hands-on can be literally hands-on in a guiding manner.
Yep.
So, well, hang on. This is how I'm going to follow you doing this movement, and now I'm going to guide you into the correct movement pattern, which is similar to anyone who's had golf tuition or tennis tuition, where they're not quite getting a shot right, and the coach might put their arms around and say, well, let me guide you through. That's what a forearm feels like.
Yeah.
So once you know what something feels like, you can repeat it.
How does this compare with the traditional physio approach then? And I say physio is a general term for anyone doing physical therapy. But
where somebody has got a weakness, where someone's sort of got a weakness, but you guide it, and you think, well, hang on a minute, now that you've felt what you should be doing, you can make the adjustment. You just lost the movement program for how to do it, and now you found it. You felt, oh, that's much better. The same as we might suddenly, instantly get a drive 50 yards on a golf ball because we just rotate our hands in the right way. Because with our hands as neurophysios, what we're doing is we're guiding the movement, but we're also having our own feedback in terms of how much help am I having to give you in every part of the range. Yeah. Are there parts of this where I could let my hands go and you'd be completing the movement, or are there parts where I'm physically not only following you and just giving you movement hints as to where you should be going, I'm actually physically giving you some support? Then we're chaining that back in our reasoning and thinking, okay, because I had to give you support, I now know that you've got a weakness in your rotator cuff, or you've got a weakness in this, you've got a weakness in that. And then we start thinking, right, what is the standard physiotherapy, sports medicine, what's the standard strengthening approach? And start thinking again about gravity. If I want elbow flexion, I might want to start with gravity eliminated. Yeah. So the neuro proviso is looking at, as a consequence of doing the elbow, am I actually getting tone creeping into somewhere else?
Yeah.
So if someone had a weak elbow and I was working against gravity, I might find the hand tightens up. But if I said, well, look, we want to get that biceps activity going better, so what we do is get on a kitchen table, we'll put an oven mitt on your hand and get you to slide across there so that you're eliminating gravity and eliminating the friction.
Wax on, wax off.
Wax on, wax off, yeah. and you also, we're also feeling as well, is there a restriction to movement in terms of increased tone in the right. antagonist? So then hands-on becomes, again, very similar to everyone else's soft tissue work in terms of we're actually going to try and work on the opposing muscle yeah. itself.
You started that by, you prefaced it by saying, as neurophysios we yeah. do this. If someone, if an ordinary physio, and for that again I mean probably any ordinary a manual practitioner, yeah. gets a stroke patient, what do you imagine happens in clinic? Should they be referring to you, or is there stuff that we should all be doing?
It's interesting, because I think there's a few answers to that. If you've got a client who you know really well, and you've looked after them when they twisted their ankle when they were playing football, and you've looked after them yeah. when they put their back out, you know, this, you've got a long-term relationship, and this person has a mild neurological condition, you're the person that helped them before, so they've got a huge amount of trust. They're going to do what you said, because they know, from an exercise point, they know what you said before has yeah. Has worked. And you've got a really good route map of, well, I know how you moved before, and I can actually see you know, where the deviation is. And if it looks that it's more about a weakness issue, and then you put your orthopedic head on and think, okay, well, that muscle is weak, let's think about how I might strengthen that, whether I'm using TheraBand or lightweights yeah. or whatever. But in the back of your mind, you're taking that step back and thinking, as a consequence of them doing the correct orthopedic strengthening movement to get that isolated muscle back,
yeah.
what is happening more globally? And going back to your original question with your was it chat with the stroke?
Yes.
Yes. Now, one of the challenges for the upper limb in the neurological patient is that it can often be the latissimus, huge muscle,
yeah.
and if you look at the sport from a sporting point of view, like your swimmers swimmers and climbers have got amazing lats, because they're you know, you've got from a freestyler, yes. you've got all the components that you want a lat to do, yep. medial retake, extend from flexion and adduct. Climbers, it's evolutionary. That muscle has got numerous attachments throughout the spine, from the hip, through the thoracolumbar fascia, up into the groove on the tricep, bicipital groove, isn't yep. it? The lady between yes. two minors, I seem to remember from 20 years ago. Now, often we're working, and this is the interesting thing in normally innervated individuals, we can have different parts of the muscle working concentrically, eccentrically, and isometrically all at the same time. Because very few muscle fibers run from origin to insertion.
Mm.
A good example of that is in gait. So if you think of the hamstrings, as you swing, proximally, that hamstring from the ischium is actually getting longer,
yeah.
but distally it's giving you knee flexion, it's getting shorter. So what you often find in stroke patients is if they've got a loss of selective hip flexion and they've got an element of foot drop, then they may hitch their hip to safely clear the ground. Well, the problem is the muscle they use to hitch the hip with is the latissimus.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't just, in an isolate, you or I could stand up and just hitch our hip and have no influence on our upper limb, because that would stay either quiescent or isometric. When yeah. a stroke patient hip hitches, they'll get almost like an all or nothing, so it'll concentrically contract. So suddenly that arm is adducting.
Okay.
And that's been quite active. Also, they tend to lose a lot of the postural control. And again, having a super big muscle like the latissimus can splint the trunk,
yeah,
so that you get quite a lot of trunk rigidity, but again it pulls the arm into the side, so yeah. some upper limb spasticity yeah. again can be due to that. So a lot of it is in assessing these neurological patients is taking that step aside, thinking, what problem are they trying to solve? Are they trying to solve a balance problem, a gait problem? What muscles could they be using that? And then to think, hang on a minute, how does that muscle globally work? So,
and what is your approach in the case that you've just hypothesized?
So for that person, the first thing to do is to try and release the latissimus.
Hmm.
Now, sometimes that can be just with soft tissue mobilizations. Right. Other times, then we've got our own sort of set of techniques that we would use to actually loosen off the trunk, and that's often a combination of guided movements with breathing. Because the other thing that a lot of stroke patients do is, in order to not slither out of the chair when they're sat by their bedside, they often use respiratory muscles to act as postural muscles.
Yeah.
So they'll take a big breath in and breathe at a really high lung volume. Mm. And again, a lot of the accessory muscles of respiration also attach around the shoulders. And I think that's probably is, the, in a nutshell, one of the big differences with a neurological patient and an orthopedic patient is just how many systems can be brought in for that patient to achieve their goal. There can be very knotted clinical reasoning.
And going back to your gait patients, and again, you've mentioned this earlier on, but I'm just trying to come completely to terms with it. It's not enough simply to work on latissimus, because you've got to take away the need to hitch the hip, which is avoiding the foot drop through electrical stimulation.
Okay. So if we go back and look at number 12. So this is a chap who's had a stroke. So he's got a fairly, if we play that video, he's got a fairly marked foot drop. So you can see he actually is having to hitch that hip.
Yeah.
So he'll be activating that latissimus. And exactly as you said, we could loosen it off, but if we're not addressing the cause of that problem. So he's walking up a hill, catching that foot with every step. Now, this is where, from a technology point of view, the standard orthopedic, as the standard orthotic approach, might be to put that gentleman into a splint that would hold that angle at 90 degrees. Challenge for that is, if you've got an ankle at 90 degrees, he's walking up the hill, and you can see on the left foot he's going into a fair degree of dorsiflexion. So if you fix that at 90, you might stop the foot drop, but you'll then affect his balance walking uphill. So if we play the next video in that sequence, which I think is 11, we'll see the result of the perineal.
Was this particular patient one that you've treated yourself?
No, he's
so we've lost the videos at the moment.
So again, it's just about to play. So he's got a perineal nerve stimulation, the same as the gentleman that we saw earlier.
This is with the heel pressure sensor, which triggers the perineal.
And as that video plays, we'll now see he's getting heel strike. And what's really nice is he's lost the stick.
Yeah.
We've lost the hip hitch. And we're actually starting to involve his head. He's looking around now. His whole focus of attention was down, down on his foot. So yes, so with someone who is having to use latissimus to give a hip hitch, then you've got to solve the peripheral problem as well.
It'll save him quite a lot on worn out shoes as well, isn't it? He's not dragging his toes anymore.
I've had a couple of clients remark on that. Do you know what? Actually, although these can be expensive devices, by the time you add the shoe leather into it, become quite cost effective.
What's the mechanism then with your system? I mean, you've got a number of clinics across the country, and we'll make sure that people know where those clinics are, because our members are all over the place as well. They would approach you. You'd sort of say, "We'll send them along." And they would see you how often,
our website is www.physiofunction.co.uk. Yeah. So on that website is a central number. So that's run by my client services department.
Yeah.
So they will find out geographically where that person is, in Yorkshire, the Midlands, or London, find out a little bit more about the condition. Because we've got 30-35 physios working with us. So some of us have got skill, I've got a lot of experience perhaps in one pathology more than another. So locally, I might say, well, okay, my caseload probably is more towards 60-70% stroke patients.
Yeah.
And I might, some of my colleagues has perhaps had more experience with MS. So sometimes just on a condition we might divide the work.
And how does your approach differ between MS, stroke, cerebral palsy?
So with MS, there can be, because the element of, there is a big element of fatigue in it, so there's a lot of fatigue management, and I think psychologically it's quite a tough condition to deal with, because with a stroke or spinal injury or head injury, you've kind of, something bad has happened, and there is the kind of, the only way is up, and you're hoping that each day brings, oh, I'm feeling a bit loose, I'm feeling a bit stronger. And I think conditions such as that have got a regressive nature can be quite psychologically tough.
What do you mean by fatigue management? How do you go about that?
So,
other than getting sleep.
Well, typically with someone with MS, it's helping them, you know, understand that balance between rest and activity and thinking through the whole week. Yeah. So, if they want to go out in the evening, then think about what's happening in the rest of the day. So we often use an analogy of a fuel tank. So if I've just been to Sainsbury's and I've filled my fuel tank up, I'll go on any little journey I need to go, and I won't consider it. Yeah. But when it's Sunday and you're out in the sticks and you go, oh, crumbs, the red light is blipping, you'll only do those really important journeys. Mm. I'll ration that fuel.
Right.
So it's about helping people ration that fuel. So it might be, well, look, on this morning, if I'm going out in the evening, I'll drive the kids to school, versus if I'm not going out in the evening, we'll be encouraging you to walk your children to school, because that's your opportunity to have exercise. And I think often in those scenarios as well, there's a lot of psychological support for the client as well as the physical stuff.
And what's the progression in something like MS? You're not going to overcome the physiological damage of MS, are you? So are they just going to get fitter and therefore be able to manage greater exercise?
That's a really interesting question. If we think of all of us that aren't kind of honed athletes, we've got the potential to improve our physical functioning. We've got muscles that are used to working in the environment we're an on-demand system, really.
Yeah.
So, and that same flexibility is with an MS client. So they will have muscles where you'll have the plaques, you lost the saltatory conduction, so they can't bring the motor end plate to give a tetanic contraction. But they'll also have sets of motor units that just haven't been exercised. So you've got some slack in that system straight away. Mm. But, well, hang on a minute. You and I could decide, well, sorry, I don't know about your athletic prowess, but I could decide, right, I'm definitely in the London Marathon.
Cutting edge, I would say.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I might say, no, this is, 2016 is my London Marathon year, and I could set about training for that. Perhaps I'm being naive, but I think I'd do it. Wouldn't be a brilliant time, but I could do it, because I'm just training muscles that have not been used to that extent. So with the MS, people with MS, you've got those unaffected muscles that just haven't been working. So again, you're back to some of your traditional muscle strengthening. They're weak. And sometimes the mere diagnosis can sort of create a bit of inactivity, because it's quite a blow.
Yes.
So they can then sort of say, oh, I've got MS. They've gone on the internet, and suddenly they can end up decreasing their activity.
Yeah, self-fulfilling philosophy to some extent, isn't it? Because you see it, you get so depressed at the idea that you've got it.
That's right. Now, so that's the first thing where you definitely make a really positive influence, because you're actually only dealing with an undamaged part of the system. Now, where I sort of work quite closely with orthopaedic colleagues with MS is the MS patient may first come into an osteopath or an MS MSK physio with backache. So I've got a diagnosis of MS, but I'm used to feeling a little bit tired, and I'm used to my fingers feeling a bit fuzzy, but it's my back. And you've got back pain on your website, or I remember you sorted out my tennis elbow years ago, have a look at it. And then you look at that patient, and they've now got mechanical back pain, but the reason they've got mechanical back pain is that they're now compensating for weakened muscles.
Yeah.
So very often in early MS, the abdominals get affected. So And most of the general public have got, you know, especially people that fly a desk for a living, have got poor abdominals. So you add a condition that will further weaken the abdominals. And then suddenly, in order to maintain an upright posture, rather than having a nice balance between your back extensors and your abdominals, they're firing big time on the extensors, and not just the small multifidus, they're going full on the long extensors. They've got exaggerated lordosis. And actually, from a manual therapy point of view, just changing the angle, so getting them to stretch those out, going back almost to McKenzie, knees onto the chest, can give them a tremendous relief of the pain. So then you're thinking, okay, we've started to get on top of that pain. Now let's look at strengthening those abdominals, because they were weak before you had the diagnosis. And then now you've got this opportunity of, taking away the pain, strengthening the abdominals that haven't been affected, that were just weak before. And of course, once you start working those back extensors too hard, that gives an inhibitory drive to the abdominals. So you can rebalance it. And then it's taking a step back and thinking, okay, what else is that? Have they got a foot drop? And so are they hip hitching as well?
Yeah. There are going to be people in the audience who are going to have trouble believing you're a physiotherapist, because we've been going now for 45 minutes and you haven't mentioned core stability once. Which is that because you don't believe in core stability as a treatment regime in its own right? Or I mean, you're talking about abdominals as a muscle group, which is...
It's just a term I hate.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear it.
I just loathe it. Yeah. It just makes me think of a discarded apple core.
Right.
It's poorly understood. People don't know a lot.
I think that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's misapplied. Yeah. It's not that it's a poor approach.
So I mean, for example, I've seen many MS patients. I said, well, okay, what exercises have you been given? Oh, I've been doing bridging. So he said, well, that's interesting. Can you display a bridge for me? And they'll do this. The bottom will be a long way off the bed, but the bridge they'll give me will be with a hyperlordosis, and that's not stability. That's just a very that's just activity. Yeah. So to me, I try and get those individuals to think, well, hang on a minute. If we're going to call it bridging, which is often termed in physio land, so well, let's not think of a railway bridge with an arch. Let's think of a Harrison Ford Raiders of the Lost Ark bridge.
Yeah.
So I don't want your bottom. I don't want your bottom a foot off the bed. I want it 2 inches off the bed. I want you to stop at the point where you flip from a gentle curve, a rope bridge type curve, into a railway bridge type curve. So that we get that balance between the abdominals and the back extensors, and then that's the point that you stop that exercise. And of course, in order to really then progress, you then wanting to take involve limbs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think
and there's a very famous, very well known osteopath, Eyal Lederman, who teaches a lot of neurological rehabilitation, and it's all about what you've been talking about functional stuff. It's getting the body to do what it's meant to do, rather than artificial constructs like your railway bridge. I think is kind of the same thing.
And of course, I think stability I find an interesting concept, because if you look at what they're called, the skyscrapers, that's not a stable structure. That's an inherently unstable structure. It has to move. If the top of a table of a skyscraper did not move a few centimetres, it would suffer tremendous damage in high winds. And that's the thing with an overarched bridge. It's fixed. It's not. And I think core stability. It's getting this idea. It's dynamic stability.
Yes.
Adaptive stability and adaptive control. So I just hate that. Use it all the time, because it's the basis upon which we balance and move and maintain good posture. But it's such a misused, misapplied word. It's dropped from my vocabulary.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. I'm going to take you back to talking about elite athletes, which you did a little while ago. We have our own elite athlete, which
is... Oh, we do indeed.
No, we do here. Holly is an elite cyclist, and she saw that you had a video on your list which was involved a cyclist, and she's desperate to see what you did with the cyclist. So is that something we can bring in at this stage, or is that a different...
Right, so... You got me there.
It's definitely there because you saw it when we were opening
them up. So we do that one. Yeah. Okay, so actually that's a good, there's a nice mix. So is that playing now? So this gentleman, we might have to loop it a couple of times. So he's got a nasty combination of a head injury and a spinal cord injury. So he's a wheelchair dependent individual. That's him sat in the wheelchair. You can see that left leg for a guy of his obvious of his build. You wouldn't expect to be as thin as that. So he's got some atrophy going on there, and that's obviously just disuse atrophy. So if you get an individual like that to have their legs driven by a passive exercise device, any remaining intact fibers, can we keep playing that? Is that okay? Any remaining fibres will join in.
Mm-hmm. Even though it's passive?
Yes, you can't switch off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you think of any clinical examination when you want to explore passive range of movement, they'll join in, won't they?
Yes.
It's really hard. So repetitive, active assisted passive cycling will have a positive result. On this gentleman, what we've also done is we've put electrical stimulation onto his thighs. So that bike is now being actively driven by his muscle activity.
Yes.
So he's driving the pedals with the assistance of the motor, and you get a super additive effect. So you'll improve the circulation, you'll improve the cross-sectional diameter of the of the muscle. Now, for an individual like that, who is wheelchair dependent, actually growing some muscles gives him something to sit on.
Yes.
I always think of the glutes as being a bit like a hovercraft. So if you imagine a hovercraft on a beach and then the air fills up the skirt, the hovercraft rises up off the beach. Yes. And that's really what our whole gluteal structure should be doing. So if
you've got stimulation on both his legs.
He's got hamstrings, quads and glutes. He's got six channels.
His right leg looks less wasted than the left. Is that just an effect of perspective, or
I think it's an effect of perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and what was the outcome for him? How far did he get?
So the outcome for him is his legs have now started to grow. So he's actually got a much better base to sit on, and because of a better base to sit on, he's now got getting less neck pain.
Right.
But what's also interesting is that we all learnt about muscles as being primary organs of locomotion and movement.
Yeah.
Muscles, origin insertion, cross one or more joints, they shorten, movement occurs. Mm. But what's emerging is that muscles are also organs of metabolism. So if you look at the rates of diabetes in wheelchair users, they are higher than they are in the general population. Statistically higher, because they're not using their glutes and they're not using their muscles. There isn't a jump in diabetes rates between paraplegics and tetraplegics, and that difference spans the kidneys.
Yeah.
So it's not like they've lost nerve supply. It seems to be that our big muscles, our quads and our glutes, do more than motor activity. They have a metabolic role. So potentially over time, that will help with the avoidance of diabetes and also have an influence on the immune system as well.
So let's take somebody unlike this gentleman here. Yeah. Let's take a Paralympian who are using their upper body a lot. Yeah. So presumably their metabolic rate is being stimulated. It's a bit higher. Do those same statistics apply?
I think it's interesting because they're very different muscle structures.
Mm.
So you've got lots of dense capillaries. So from a fitness point of view, from heart health, that can be really quite beneficial because it is quite a load on a healthy heart.
Yeah.
As the Canadians found out in very early excess physio, they looked at it. Maybe the listeners maybe remember where the studies looked at why did so many Canadians drop dead in the winter shoveling snow, and it's because of the heart of unfit people trying to power up and get blood through very small muscle beds was enough back effort on the heart. So probably from heart health, people at David Weir would be great,
yes.
But it does seem to be the thigh and the glutes that have this diabetes protection. But looking at Holly and her elite cycling, Mark Cavendish is very keen on using electrical stimulation after the event. So when we're looking at this gentleman, he's loading up, he's going for a strong tetanic contraction to drive those pedals. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So what you can also do is use lower frequencies that involve less total motor units, but that can actually flush out some of the metabolites of exercise to avoid muscle soreness the next day.
Okay.
Those devices are also you could potentially increase an able-bodied cyclist raw power in the saddle because you will get the assistance of volitional activity plus electrical stimulation will give you a stronger tetanic contraction. And I think that comes down to the Renshaw cells that we've got a self-inhibiting system.
Yes.
So we can the maximum voluntary contraction that we can generate is as a function of inhibition, so that we don't break our own break our own bones.
Yep.
And if you look at early use of electroconvulsive shock therapy for depression, what they found was that people actually broke. Because they're stimulating the brain, they were actually then stimulating motor neurons, and people would snap their thighs.
Yeah.
Able-bodied, depressed, young, fit people, because if this goes 100% contraction, that's strong enough to break a long
which
bone.
Which is phenomenal, isn't it? We were doing some dissections at Keele University, and they showed us the machine which they use to to fracture cadaveric thighs.
Right.
And it's a phenomenal amount of force that's needed to do that. And so I think that your own muscles are capable of doing that if you take away that inhibition.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah.
I've had a question from the audience, or two parts to the question, really. How long after somebody's had a stroke could the techniques, the methods that you've just described still be effective? Or is there a period at which they cease to be of any effect?
Right.
And we do talk about getting to stroke victims very quickly, don't we?
It's one of my favourite questions.
Right.
Now, that gentleman that we saw walking down the corridor with his arm up here, and then some 18 months later running down the corridor.
Yeah.
Although it looked like he had a head injury, so it's kind of like a stroke, but with some external damage. The effect on the brain is the same. You've got brain damage, and it's one sided. The first time I saw him, he was 12 years. Post head injury.
Golly.
So from the point that he was walking up and down that corridor to when he was running down another corridor, that was at year 13 and a half.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big window.
Yeah.
And I think most saddening things for me is you'll hear physicians refer to, you've got 18 months or two years or 2.5 years, and after that point, then that's it for you. You've plateaued.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, what happens is that is often in the NHS there is we know it's resource limited. So, if the physicians are constantly seeing the consequences of constrained resources, they're making their clinical judgment on the basis of that. So they've seen, after 2 years, I don't see any changes. Well, that's probably because they stopped having rehabilitation a year or 12 months. You're seeing not the consequences, not the plateauing of a neurological recovery, you're seeing the effect
But the mindset gets reinforced, doesn't it? Because that's what you see when they finish their treatment, that's what you expect for the next one who comes.
And so then when someone asks for more physio, you don't give them more physio or more rehab because they're not getting it. So to me, the immediate effect of a big neurological insult, be it a stroke or a head injury, is you've got brain damage, you've got swelling. So that's like having your foot on the garden hose. You're not going to get things firing up. There's an element of cerebral shock. Hopefully that will diminish fairly quickly, and then you'll start to see the beginnings of what is really a spontaneous recovery.
Yeah.
You will then have release of lots of growth hormones, which will then help with the early stages of plasticity. And again, that's part of a evolutional brain repair system. It's by and large spontaneous. So to me, for the recovery you often see in the first 3 months is kind of spontaneous. It's about reduction in swelling, and it's about the rewiring that's available, enhanced by growth hormones.
So this will happen regardless of any intervention.
So all you've got to do in the acute setting is not mess it up. Just help them. Make sure they don't fall out of bed. Make sure they don't develop bad habits. Hold them back a little bit from the dreadful hip hitching walk until their hip flexors have got stronger.
Yeah.
From that point, that the levels of the growth hormone have started to subside, the swelling's gone down. From that point on, it's all about retraining unaffected brain. Now, there's no end to when would you stop retraining unaffected brain? It's unaffected. So if you and I perhaps might have 15, 20 years of our career ahead, and we might decide, well, you know what the first thing we do when we retire, we're going to learn to play golf, we'll learn to fly fish, or we'll learn to do crown bowls. So we can learn a new motor skill at any point in our in our life. So there isn't there is no rehab window.
Yeah.
You just, there's a constraint, a physical constraint, just at how much damage has been done.
Yeah.
So there'll be a potential stopping point, but it's not time based. It's damage based.
This is quite refreshing to hear, and it seems to be a bit of a mystery in the physical therapy world, because most people would say, for stroke particularly, 2 years, that's it, that's what you've got. And there must be a lot of practitioners who like, and genuinely I am surprised to hear that, because that gives me a lot of hope for friends and patients who've suffered.
I did a talk for the British Association of Rehabilitation Physicians. So it's basically a room full of the people that run these neurological units. And we had a catastrophic IT failure, so all my beautiful videos were not running. So I thought, I'll have to fill a bit of space here. So I said, right, while we're getting this video sorted, I've been listening to my patients for a long time now, and they all tell me that there's a point beyond which they won't get recovery. And it's some of them tell me they've been told that it's a year, some have said it's 18 months, some have said it's 2 years, some have said it's 2.5. And I'd like you guys to help me, because I've not been able to find the research paper that backs this up. Yeah. So if any of you could just tell me in the audience here, which is the piece of paper that the research thing, the Archives of Physical Medicine, that says there's a window and it closes at 2.5. You could have heard that it was tumbleweed time, because it doesn't exist.
Okay. Well, again, I'm really pleased about that. I mean, it must make your job really, really, really satisfying and rewarding.
It does, and I think for me as well is that when I started my private practice, 12, 13 years ago, I was only ever seeing stroke patients who were 2.5, 3, 4, 5 years down the line, because the NHS is even that time has changed in its provision, and I was making these guys better.
Yes.
So, I built my initial practice on the fact that this window is just nonsense. It's actually about...
I need to go back to your cyclist. And we don't need to see the video again, but I think you kind of mentioned this. The question from the audience is, will the bike that he was on build muscle mass as well as help the neurological deficit, bearing in mind that it was passive movement that was being generated there? Okay. And I think your answer was yes, because
If you Google, it's called FES cycling, functional movement, the very well researched, and you'll get increases in cross-sectional area of the muscle.
This is fascinating for lazy buggers like me. It means I can sit on a bike and be passively driven and still build muscle mass while I eat donuts.
Yeah, which is... yeah. It's how Slendertone created their their base. But I mean, spinal cord injury is really interesting from the point of view of unless somebody has been stabbed with a samurai sword. Yeah. Or because I do some work down at Headley Court with the soldiers, so some people have got a huge lump of shrapnel that's gone through their spine, but most of the time there is no such thing as a complete spinal cord injury. There is something.
Okay. Yeah.
So when you put those guys on those bikes, there's an element of rewiring. Now, if we go back to my hovercraft analogy, what we'd like to see is the glutes growing, the hovercraft coming completely off the beach. But if you can get something going volitionally so they can do an activity in the chair and that makes a difference, that's still going to lift them up off the ground, off the bed.
Another question that's come in is that if we were to refer patients to your centres, would there be scope for practitioners like us to assist in their prescribed rehab with the exercise equipment or the muscle stimulation that they've
absolutely
been given?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say,
is there special training for that, or is it fairly straightforward?
In terms of the stimulation type stuff, then we'd program it. Yeah. So, and then there's a few parameters you can increase, and we'd go through that with the patient and the other practitioner. But of course, the key thing is to say, well, you were trying to combine this with the exercise. So, so to have someone also supervising that exercise is brilliant. And the other thing is that the patients themselves may, at the same time as you're working on strengthening one particular set of muscles, we're still wanting all the soft tissue work to release the others to make more movement possible. So often it can be a very nice synergy.
And how would the practitioners get that information? Would they have to come to you, or can you do this by email?
We always welcome collaborative working anyway, but appreciate if for busy private practitioners, it's always a trade-off between work with other clients, paid work they've got to do versus coming with the
but
client.
It's not something that would be wasted, is it? I mean, they come along once, and then they've learned for any
similar
patient.
Exactly, that's my thought as well. And to be fair, these days with reflective learning, CP diaries, it's actually, you write that up and how that's influenced your practice, and that is actually a very useful CPD anyway. So we'd welcome them to come in. Other times, I mean, the great thing with smartphones now is, whereas before we were, drawing stick men, or using physio tools or whatever. Yeah. You can't
just video them.
Yeah. Phone video, you just can't. It's fantastic. Yeah. And the amount of, you'll rarely see a phone now that hasn't got some kind of video facility. So we use that a lot. So we'll take the phone off the patient and say, look, we're going to video on your phone so you've got it. If they've not got a smartphone with them, then we'll do it on ours. Email it to them, so then they can share that with their
we are, we're not running out of time yet, but there's a limited amount left, and I think we need to move on to, you talked about complete spinal disruption earlier on, and I think it's time to introduce our mystery guest, who I believe his name is Rex, which you will tell us stands for.
That's a good point, a robot exerciser.
Oh, I thought it was exoskeleton, right, okay, robot exerciser, right. And this is designed to deal with people with injuries to the spinal cord from what level?
So this is basically anyone from lower lumbar right the way up to high cervical.
Wow.
Let's have a look. You
point it out. And
right. So this device...
I'll stand in it. Okay. And I would normally be strapped in around the waist and the legs.
So you would normally have a calf strap, a thigh strap, a groin harness and a waist strap.
And a wheelchair user can get into this as long as they've got use of their arms.
Yes. Or if they're, see the higher, whoops, hmm? the higher the level of lesion.
He's just locked the controls. Yeah, I can't go running off.
Yeah. So the higher the level of lesion, the more likely it is that there'll be carers involved.
Yes.
So the highest level I've had in here is a C4 ventilated gentleman. Wow. So that's... he and So we had the ventilator on the back.
Yes.
This set high so that he yep. had some trunk. He had had some trunk support, and then yep. we used the controls. But for him yep. to have that opportunity of walking, he's only 18, 19, to yep. walk through space was brilliant. So it normally sits down. So yep. I won't see yes. you all the way down, but I'll just demonstrate it again.
Yeah, I haven't practiced this.
A little bit towards sitting. Mm-hmm. Yep. So you imagine if I finished that off, you'd be sat through the set. So it goes from sit to standing.
And this is very stable. I mean, I'm wiggling a little yeah. just to see what happens. And it's obviously very stable.
Yeah, I mean, it weighs 50 kilos, which, yeah. and it's set up so that it always keeps the centre of gravity, you know, within a stable mm. stable base. Yeah. The walking in it is slightly different to human gait, because at any single point it is completely stable, whereas yeah. in human gait there is points of mm. of not being stable, not being balanced, but you're yes. effectively walking is repeatedly falling forwards and gaining your balance. Mm. So if you push the knob forwards and hold it forwards, so we've got a weight transfer. I put this on to learner driver speed.
How fast could I go?
Don't say. So you can go about twice this speed.
But this is curious. You know, this is leaning over quite a long way as
yeah.
we.
So you've got to clear that a bigger foot than yeah. your foot there. So if we stop that, come off there,
and it's going to bring me
to a stop. Now, sometimes what we do, because we use this not only with spinal injury patients, we use it with stroke patients. Mm. So the fact that it's got an exaggerated weight transfer, we're staying there for the moment, yeah. can in its own way be quite useful. So if we do a weight transfer so I can stop it at this point here, mm. and I've now got weight through there, so we can start to explore. So I take your hand, we can then start to explore right. your balance around yeah. around this side.
Okay.
So we use the exaggerated transfer within therapy. Because often, if you think of a stroke patient, they may have a double whammy. They may fear yeah. going onto their weaker side, yeah. so we can actually bring them safely onto their weaker side yeah. and start to exercise them
balancing safely.
We might
have to walk back a few steps, won't we? So we yeah. get the cameras back on us again.
So, so if you pull walk back towards us,
you're hanging on to me as though something dreadful is going to happen, but it's...
I think having you fall out my device on live stream TV would be embarrassing. The
going backwards is a very strange thing.
It is. So if you come off it now... That's it. Now, in reality, your floor is quite an interesting shape.
Yes.
Yeah, get the carpenters back in.
Yeah.
So it can cope with about a 2 degree difference in camber.
That's Rex.
That's Rex. So when I put somebody in there for the first time, very much hold them, because I've seen you walk over there. So we're actually in a very exciting project with it at the moment.
Yeah.
It's a research trial called Rapper 2. These devices, they come from New Zealand. It was designed by two Scottish engineers. Started off typical engineer style, back of a fag packet in a pub, and a few years later they've now got a production model. It's been kite marked, so it's a safe device.
Yes.
And it's going for its FDA approval. But part of the research is to demonstrate for the spinal cord population that they can safely demonstrate it rather than mathematically prove it. So demonstrate yeah. that it they can safely transfer into it, they can sit to stand, they can walk, turn, sit down and perform. Because yeah. the nice thing about it, your arms are completely free. And of course in a wheelchair, you've suddenly, your arms now become your mode of
yes.
locomotion.
But I had to hold the joystick on that to make it, can it be set so that you don't have to hold the joystick?
When you're in the process, when you're physically moving, you've got to hold the joystick. But yeah. when you get to the bar,
you
get
your drinks,
you can go back.
Yeah.
When you're at the kitchen, Yeah. You can beast at the unit, cutting up your veggies.
Yeah.
When you're at your workbench, you can be planing your whatever you're doing. So it gives you function in standing. So,
and that's going to have, presumably, there's not just the mobility issues here. You're no longer spending all your life sitting, which is good. The psychological benefits must be astounding.
There's huge psychological benefits. But the interesting thing is in this trial, we've done the first 20 of 100. It's a worldwide trial.
This is cutting edge stuff, then.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we've done the first 20. It's been accepted for the European Congress of Neurorehabilitation in Vienna. A second trial site's coming on in Australia shortly, and the States. So this first trial is to take 100 people to demonstrate that it's safe for that population, and then the subsequent studies will say, look, we know it feels great, but what are the psychological benefits? What are the physiological benefits? In the first 20, we've had some amazing feedback. We've had people that said, well, look, this is for three days after walking in that for 20 minutes, I've had more reduction in spasms than I've had at any time since my spinal cord injury.
Yeah.
Other people have said the next day, the difference it made to my morning bowel regime was a game changer, because for people that are permanent wheelchair users, their day will be a success or a failure it's nitty gritty whether they have a successful bowel movement. If they don't have a successful bowel movement, they can feel not like having breakfast. They have breakfast, they don't have any energy. Yeah. So we're looking over this 100 as to what's the common denominator. Is it the spasticity? Is it better bowel control? Is it what psychological benefits? To then in subsequent trials to be able to measure that, to then look at what are the health benefits? Because at the moment, these devices, they're commercially available and they're funded through generally accident insurance.
Yes. What's the cost of one of these?
They're £95,000. They're a lot. Yeah. So,
has anyone had a sum on the saving to the National Health Service if someone can have their own mobility?
And this is the data we need to get. So the Rapid 2 will give us the baseline safety to then give the satisfy any ethics committee anywhere in the world that this is a safe device. Now let's see what the health benefits are. But if you're getting people up and walking, then you've got you're reducing pressure, risk of pressure sores, you're reducing risk of backflow into the kidneys. So any number of things that might mean a hospital stay can generate cash savings. These have got a 4-year lifespan.
Is that all?
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
Well, good point. So from an insurance point of view, if we're putting that into a legal claim, we have to sort of declare a lifespan. So if you imagine when you buy a car, you might have a 4-year deal with the car, with the garage. At the end of that, you have your little balloon payment to make. So yeah, we'll have to see whether at 4 years they're worth trading in.
But and the battery life is 2 hours, I think.
Is 2 hours. Comes with two batteries, and that's 2 hours of continuous walking. But you're looking at, can you save, between £20,000 and £25,000 a year? Mm. Well, the cost of looking after someone on dialysis is £30,000. So, if by getting someone mobilising that device, and you're improving their genital urinary system, they are, because they're loading and unloading, because of course a spinal cord injury is just a blockage, it's like having the tubes not working in London. Yeah. Well, if I want to get to Brighton's still running up to Victoria and Euston's still running up to Northampton, it's just there's a bit of a mess in the middle. Same with spinal cord injury, there's still activity.
Yeah. So signals are being sent one way or another.
Exactly. If you can get the load, unload, because the body likes that. Yeah. So the fact that, wedding rings and wristwatches, we first put them on, ooh, I feel that, and then we tune out to it, and the same way we tune out to our clothing, the body, the nervous system responds to change. Mm. Or something that's static, stood in a standing frame for a lot of spinal cord patients, the system goes, oh, no, and then switches off.
Yeah.
But load, unload wakes it up. Yeah. So I think we'll see changes again in time in muscle girth, because it's load, unload, that's going to influence pressure sores. And improve the metabolic functioning of the thigh and the bottom. So I think we will see genuine health savings, and also potentially it's a device that could make the difference to get somebody back at work. Yes. So in New Zealand, they've actually got a surgeon does his surgery in one of those because he's got a spinal cord injury. So he's in the operating theatre in a very clean and scrubbed version of one of those. Yeah. I've got a chap who is his is being made at the moment in New Zealand, and he's a car resprayer. So he's going to be using that to functionally every day to do these custom paint jobs. And whilst that's not going to generate a phenomenal amount of income for him, just that feeling of of a successfully completed project is a huge psychological benefit.
Yeah.
And again, that's got...
And that's immeasurable, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, what you were saying feeds into the question that's just come in, which is how many treatments and at what cost before the robots make a difference? Then we're not looking at spinal cord repairing itself, are we? But can the NHS cover it and provide enough appointments to really make a difference, or is it all down to a patient paying?
No, research? I mean, that's what's really interesting is this person that we saw who said they had 3 days of spasm relief on a 20-25 minute walk. So her spasm using medication is not controlled. The medications themselves having a dampening influence on her mood and her attention levels. Thinking, well, if 2 20-minute treatments a week could then affect, so she went on had a treatment on Monday and Thursday. If that gave her 7 days of release from spasm, then even if they were funding it privately, she would pay for that because that's just a game changer for her life. But also, it's something that you could then go back to the NHS and say, well, look, the tizanidine, the baclofen, the drugs that are being used that aren't even being effective are costing this. There is a saving. There's a saving to be had here. What I would say at the moment with this trial, if anybody is either treating someone with spinal cord injury, or has a friend or colleague or connections with, we're really keen to get more people as part of the trial. So we'd need to come to Northampton. Rex Barnicks themselves are subsidising the travel, and they'd get about 2 hours total with us. So they'll be up walking around and getting experience in it. So if they email rex@physiofunction.co.uk, the research coordinator will go through all that's really required. Okay. We've done 20 so far. Every single one of those 20 people was absolutely buzzed with the experience. And
I'm quite buzzed.
Yeah,
just from
we've had two come from Wales.
Yeah.
And that's quite a commitment, and they just loved it. And then we had this delightful couple that came up from London who'd only ever met as wheelchair users.
Yeah.
So I said, if you can come the same day, I'll get a second Rex. So they had their first standing up cuddle ever. I tell you, there was not a dry. There wasn't a dry eye in the house that. It was amazing. So we've added another to the research. Then we've added because we've seen these changes in terms of quality of life. So we've gone back to the ethics committee to say, look, we want to add a couple of quality of life scales. That's just going through ratification now. So we'll be restarting in about 3 or 4 weeks the trial. Yeah. So as I say, we would really love it if people could sort of contact.
Who else is doing this sort of stuff at the moment? I don't wish to sort of give away all your competitors' names if there are any, but it sounds as though there are very few people with this capability around.
This is the only Rex in the UK in daily use.
Yeah.
Stanmore Hospital have had one in their research department, so they've got a very early precursor of that. There are other exoskeletons that are being used by other physiotherapists. These involve the use of elbow crutches. So many people may have seen Claire Lomas doing the marathon with elbow crutches. So, but of course, to me as a thinking function, as soon as you put crutches in somebody, now you're loading the shoulders, and again you're taking the arms out of play.
Yeah. We are coming close to the end of this evening's broadcast. I just wanted, if I can, briefly to stray into another area of your technological expertise, because when I saw you talk at the Chris Moody Centre, you were talking about devices to measure range of motion and take out sort of practitioner bias. In
yes.
Can you tell us a bit about those?
Yes. It's the only video I haven't brought. It's a good story attached to this. We were doing at the NADEX show, which is a big disability exhibition. We were doing a physio zone where anyone visiting the show could come and meet one of our team, have some exercise advice, try various bits of technology. Yeah. And this chap rocked up, 6'4", in a full set of motorcycle leathers, and said, "Who's the boss around here?" I said, "Well, that could be me." Took his helmet. He was a bit scary. Took his helmet off. Said, "Look, he's a bit of a mad inventor." So he had a system whereby he had a Bluetooth device that could link with a PC that whatever movement you did with it would be reflected on the PC. Mm-hmm. And it turns out he and his colleagues were the real inventors of smartphones. So that whole twisting thing is an inertial measurement unit.
Yeah.
They literally took that to Steve Jobs to show him. I'll say no more. So when Steve Jobs took the idea and the technology, they then found themselves with having to find a use for what could you do with a Bluetooth device that will talk to a computer and reflect movement. So they developed some games software, and they came to us to say, "Well, can you show us how we could adapt this for stroke patients?" So we showed them various things that would help. But then we got into the discussion of what does this measure? And they said, "Well, what it measures, you know, movement." Okay, one of our challenges as therapists is measuring range of movement. Mm. Could this device be replaced the goniometer and be more accurate than our eyes? And he's an engineer, looked at me, gone out, said, "This is accurate to less than 1 degree. So they've raised some money through venture capital, and they've now got a system that it shows you avatars for 22 physiological movements, anatomical movements, and basically you attach via a little cuff, you do the movement, it automatically sends the data to the computer, so all your range of movements are there as you do them.
How does it know that that's glenohumeral movement and not compensation?
So that again, that's the nice bit where it fits back in triad, because as the therapist, you are making sure that the device works. You're making sure they're not doing a cheaty movement.
Yeah.
It's a really nice bit of kit. There is a rehab, another big exhibition called Therapy Expo. It's coming up to the NEC in November, and the device is there to be for people to have a look at. I think it's going to revolutionise clinical practice, because
and it's cheap enough to use in clinic.
It's
presumably
cheap enough to use in clinic,
because if you can buy a smartphone, then maybe we can use our smartphones for this purpose.
There are some really nice little apps for smartphones whereby you can take photographs and you can move little protractors to give you an angle. But this device is super.
Yeah.
Is super.
When would you expect to see it in clinic?
Well, they're already now. So a number of football clubs have got them. There's been a big uptake in the sporting world. But what is quite nice is because it will Bluetooth to a tablet.
Yes.
Some of the players have been trained to measure joints themselves. Yeah. So they'll have their own. So it's a little tiny dongle, and so they'll actually put it on themselves. And also, there's a team one where you can actually have it on a whole team running around and see their.
This is brilliant.
See the movement.
John, we are very much running out of time now. So you've got a 10-second answer to the question: do you work with chronic regional pain syndrome?
Yes.
Excellent. Yeah. Good. That's a good answer. Right. With effect? I mean, is it?
Yes. And
this is using the technology you were talking about earlier on.
Yes. And so some of it is actually working on, okay, is some of the movements that you're doing to avoid the chronic pain contributing to further chronic pain? So unravelling that patterning.
Yeah. Okay. John, that has been And it's been one of the most exciting broadcasts we've done, actually. Having Rex in here with you as well, it's been a real treat. What's really, really refreshing, of course, is to know that the technology isn't taking over. There's still a place for manual therapy we do.
Absolutely.
And but also there is some very important cutting-edge emerging technology which can make a big difference from a lot of the people that we see in clinic. Thank you very much
for
making the trouble to come over here, coming straight from the exhibition at the NEC. Hope everybody's enjoyed that. There's been a lot of information there. We will put as much of it up on the website as soon as we can. Obviously, the recording of the broadcast will also go up, but I will try to get up the details so that you can contact John if you have people who might fit in with his trial protocols, or if there are just patients you want to refer to one of the physio rehab clinics, physio function clinics, I beg your pardon, so you can do that as soon as possible. Hope you've enjoyed this evening. Your certificates should be available now, and we'll see you at the next broadcast.